Welcome to Season 2 of the Let's Check In podcast, a place where cultural icons and frontline experts share how they navigate life's wobblier seasons. I'm your host, Susie McAvale. Let's check in.
Do you ever wonder how our choices impact the environment? Or maybe you're curious about how to inspire change in your community. It's easy to feel overwhelmed by the challenges we face, but today we're here to shed some light on those very issues. I'm excited to introduce you to Professor Liam Smith, the director and co-founder of Behaviour Works Australia, a leading authority on behaviour change research. With over 600 projects to his name in the Behavioural Works portfolio, Liam is using a range of behavioural insights to tackle societal challenges. Liam, thank you so much for joining me here today on the Let's Check In podcast.
Thanks for having me, Susie.
Okay, so let's jump in. The topic of change is really interesting and it elicits such uncertainty in human beings. Can you tell us, why is this?
I think it's fair to say that probably one of the big lessons you learn as a behavioural scientist, at least one of the ones I learned and fairly early on, is that humans don't like change. In fact, we actively fight against it. We like certainty in our life. We like surety. We like knowing what's going to happen next. And we form habits to help reinforce those things, right? So we have these habits that really ensure that we behave similar ways, most of the time in very predictable ways and with predictable outcomes. And so when change comes along, obviously it creates uncertainty in many ways, including fear of the unknown. So what's going to happen when it changes? And we don't like that fear, and we tend to be very risk averse. And I guess the reason for this is because of this stability and this assurity that we have that really provides us with safety. So we lose safety by going into the unknown. And coupled with that, I guess, the need to take on new ideas and thoughts and accept new ways of doing things, that takes effort, right? So we don't like the effort of that. Yeah. We like the simplicity of our habits and how they work for us and how we can save some of our brain for thinking and for fun and for doing things that we enjoy by the virtue of the habits, which really help us streamline how our brain works. But then when change comes, it takes up all that space. And so we end up using more of our brain capacity for that, and it causes stress. I think one of the really good examples of change that we kind of like, but only for short periods of times, is when we go on a holiday. Our habits really serve us well, and we behave in particular ways most of our life. But then we go on a holiday, and we're forced to think about really basic things like, where do I eat, or where do I sleep, or how do I get from A to B, or what do I see around here? And at the end of a day like that, you're actually really tired because you've used your brain for all those things. And we enjoy that for a while, but if you were to do that all the time, it would really take a lot of our mental capacity. And so we tend to avoid change, and it causes stress and anxiety when it comes along.
And it's interesting that some people can do that and then others can actually gravitate towards change. I'm just thinking of people in my own life who really, they enjoy change. They actually invite it. Why is it that some of us do that and some of us actually, like you said before, gravitate to what we prefer that's comfortable?
Yeah, I guess there are some people that get comfortable with being uncomfortable and do embrace change as part of their job. Those jobs and lives require a lot more energy and a lot more effort. And for people that have that energy and effort, then they can often achieve a lot. If you think about the reverse, as someone that might get born into a certain family and live in the family home for 50 years or longer and marry the same person and stay and do the same job, they'll have efficiencies in the way they work and operate that require so much less effort. And maybe they get comfortable doing exactly that. And likewise, those that embrace the change, they get comfortable doing that. So there are these different types of people. There's a measure that we use sometimes called preference for consistency. It's a measure around how much people like to be consistent. That's a way of just sort of distinguishing different personality types, if you like, depending on what sort of type of person they are.
I talk about this when we travel overseas, and it kind of forces you to be in the moment and really not get too ahead of yourself that you can sometimes do in everyday routine.
And you're loving that change, right? So yeah. You're embracing that change, but it's only for a short amount of time, and then you will go back to your life.
True. So you are a bridge builder between academic research and practical real-world solutions. What was it that drew you into this work of really decoding behaviour?
I guess it starts with my undergraduate degree, which was in the early 90s, where I studied science and particularly ecology. And I loved that work. I was very passionate about environmental issues at that stage and still am, to be honest, but that sort of was a foundation. I then travelled a lot before sort of combining two passions into a master's in ecotourism, which sort of joined my passion for travel with my passion for environmental issues. And as part of that, I did this one project, which was looking at how we could encourage people to follow some guidelines when they were swimming with whales on the Great Barrier Reef. So the circumstance is that people go and live aboard these vessels that take people to the Outer Barrier Reef and they spend a week or so scuba diving out there. But whales sometimes come up and approach them, these particular species called the dwarf minke whale, and they're not supposed to be within 50 metres. You're not allowed to be, right? That's what the rule says, but you can't outswim a whale, right? So, so how do we manage this situation? And so we were testing some things to try and encourage people to follow some new guidelines. They weren't rules, they were just guidelines. And that really got me interested in sort of human nature interaction, but also particularly in behaviour change. Then moved to Melbourne for very personal reasons and ended up working at a zoo. And there I was doing similar things. I was trying to foster these interactions between people and animals and trying to get them to behave differently as a result of it. And indeed, I got very interested in the rationale for why we have zoos at all. And one of the reasons is so that they can try and influence people. So that really led me down that path. And that's where I did a lot of my postgraduate research in that space as well. But one of the really key moments was while I was working at a zoo, I was doing some basic science research at the same time. We were studying a frog species called the growling grass frog, and we were going out, we're trying to measure how it was moving and how it was reproducing and all these sorts of things. So it was a bit of a hark back to my undergraduate days where I did a lot of that sort of thing. And at one point they were going to fill in a pond at the zoo in order to create a new exhibit. And we knew that pond was an important breeding ground for this frog. And so we really fought quite hard to try and prevent the new exhibit happening. And failed. That moment really stuck in my mind about that these issues were people issues. We had good science. We could have had the best science in the world. And I don't think it would have made an iota of difference about changing the decision to fill in that pond. And so it really got me passionate about it. And ironically, I was presenting at a zoo conference when I bumped into a former politician who's been our chair for the entirety of Behaviour Works' 14-year life, who I presented after him and we watched each other's presentations. He was interested in behaviour change, I was interested in behaviour change, and then I founded Behaviour Works, and he was sort of always that conduit into government policy decision making, and we were doing the science of behaviour change to try and underpin those decisions.
Wow. Yeah, it sounds like that moment really spoke to you, that moment of the pond. It's funny how different doors can open as experiences kind of come upon us.
Yeah, I was angry. I was really angry, and I thought about going to the media and making a big thing about this. In the end, I didn't. To be honest, the zoo put in a bunch of policy sort of compensatory measures, if you like, to try and make up for it, which in the end worked okay, to be honest. The frog moved and it was okay. But at the time, I didn't know that and I was quite angry about it. So, yeah, it really did make me think a lot about it. Well, actually, to be honest, one of those moments I look back on and I see how important it was. But at the time, I was just really frustrated and angry.
The value of hindsight sometimes can make these things become a bit clearer, can it?
Yeah, exactly. It's just funny how you look back on things. And of course, that's the foundation of Behaviour Works. That's how we started. But we've really moved into other spaces now as well. So we cover a raft of different issues to do with the Sustainable Development Goals. So we sit inside the Sustainable Development Institute, which looks at the 17 goals and how we might use different approaches to achieve them. And behavioural science and behaviour change is one of them to help achieve all sorts of environmental and social and financial good.
Let's talk about that. So your work is quite vast and covers a range of different areas. How does it provide a framework to understand how we manage the topic of uncertainty during times of change?
It sort of is still relevant here a little bit, which is that we don't manage particularly well. We try and avoid it if we can. But change comes, right? Sometimes it comes, or often it comes to us externally. So if there's a disaster and we know they're going to be more frequent with climate change and the like, we're forced to deal with change and we have to. And sometimes we drive it internally. You know, lots of people might be doing the same job for 10 years and say, right, I've had enough of it. I need to do something. And so it sort of comes internally. And I think there's a bit of a difference in response to the question as to which of those situations there. If you drive it, then I think you've got passion for change and you're chasing change and you embrace it, actually. You're looking for something new. Whereas in the former, where change comes and is forced on you, I think it's difficult. We try and avoid it, right? And we try and lead lies of normality as much as we can. I'm always amazed when I see war-torn areas, but people are still going to work. Like the war wasn't happening around them because they're just craving that normality and they're really avoiding the stress of having to take on new thoughts, embrace new ways of working, new ways of doing, new ways of being that's hard. And so I don't know there's a simple answer to it, but what we do know is that sometimes those moments of change that come to us, they can be not as significant as a war or a disaster. They can be you move house or you get married. I mean, they're sort of things that you choose to do, or you have kids, or you change jobs. Moments of change that we often embrace, we've driven them ourselves, but we also know that that puts a lot of other things we do up for grabs. There's a guy called Bas Planken, a well-known habits researcher, who talks about habit discontinuity. And that idea is that when these natural moments of change occur during our lives, we're actually susceptible to a whole bunch of other things. And so, for example, if you hadn't moved house, if you're in the same house and I say to you, hey, Susie, there's a bus that takes you to work and it's just as quick as your car, it's very unlikely you'll change because you're used to driving the car. I'm not saying you do, but most people would stick to the current form of transport. But if you move house and I say the same thing, you're much more likely to change because we're in a moment of change. And that habit discontinuity is this idea that there are moments of natural change that we embrace and can use to drive other changes in our lives. There's also really fascinating work by someone called Katie Milkman who talks about new beginnings. So we often talk about New Year's resolutions and, you know, we don't always stick to them, but we often try. But there are like calendar dates and time cycles that also lead to increased likelihood of change. And we're more likely to respond to an email on a Monday or the first day of the month than we are on a Tuesday or not the first day of the month or the first day of a season. So there are sort of natural cycles that also lead to potential for change as well.
Yeah. Actually, it's interesting you bring that up about season changes. I distinctly remember having the memory during COVID, it's almost embarrassing to admit this, but really noticing the seasonal change that happens in our environment. Before that, I don't think I'd properly registered it in line with the energy that comes as a human being and how you have a dip towards going into winter. And that's actually okay. And you can kind of forgive yourself on some of that feeling of maybe not going to the gym or whatever you're wanting to do. But then when spring comes and summer arises, like you naturally have these feelings that come out. And I think that was one of the beautiful things of COVID for me personally that I felt. And it's just really interesting that you bring up that topic of season changes. And we know that from our Indigenous elders that they speak a lot about this space and how working with the rhythm, it's almost intuitive for us as human beings. I don't know if you've got some thoughts around.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think some of the work we've done, and I've had some doctoral students that have looked at this around connection to nature, we know that we're losing biodiversity. Australia's lost 100 species. We've got 2,000 on the endangered species list. Like, we're in trouble, right? And one of the reasons we try and point to for that is that we've become disconnected. We don't see nature like we used to. And so I think COVID did help with that, right? So I was like you, and I went for my 1 hour walk a day that we were allowed and looked at the same trees and watched them move from losing their leaves to budding again to flowering. It was fascinating to watch. And even just out my window, I have some deciduous trees, non-native, but nonetheless, that I was able to watch do the same cycles. And it really does get you back in touch. In terms of how that drives our behavior, I think it creates these opportunities of natural time cycles for new beginnings. We're more susceptible and more likely to do new things.
Mm. If we look at behaviour changes in our society across maybe the past few years, and we're in this space of conversation about COVID right now, what have really been those standout changes that have been noticed?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head with the biggest one, right? In the introduction chapter of our book, actually, we say that COVID is probably the biggest change in behaviour we've ever seen in terms of the number of people and the rapidity with which that change happened. You know, some other flus and viruses have come, but they just didn't spread, and both the disease itself and then the response didn't spread like they did with COVID. It was incredible, really, to watch how a world responded. And we all did a little bit differently. Say Australia, we embraced lockdowns, but other countries really couldn't afford the social cost of having people not working, or individuals couldn't afford it. So they took other precautions, and other governments that could afford it but wanted to trust their people more took different strategies. But we saw incredible change. And so to answer your question, I think that's the big one, but actually the ramifications of COVID are still washing out, right? So
yeah.
I think about some of the positives. So yesterday I worked from home and that was a benefit, right? I didn't have to commute. I was able to save that time and to spend more time working and not have to worry about traffic or emissions or the like. And that wouldn't have happened. 5 years ago, I wouldn't have worked from home. And I think that's true with a lot of certainly white collar workers that did that. But then on the flip side, of course, we lost social connections and kids left community sport and didn't go back. And so I think some of the bigger costs, the behavioural costs, are still sort of bearing out. And we won't know those for some time. I imagine someone will do an analysis in 20 years time and work it out. But that was the big one, really, in terms of change.
Yeah.
There are others, of course, like the global rising of the middle class is happening. People are craving more education. So that's, we've certainly seen trends around that. But there's a real desire to be educated. And we know that that correlates with actually population growth decline, still growing, but not by anywhere near as much as we used to. So there's some of the big picture things that obviously are changing. And I guess one of the things that's more in my area is around green consumerism. So we're certainly seeing an uptick in voting. So we saw the rise of the Teals here in Australia and that sort of mix between traditional Liberal voters and climate and who are really worried and concerned about climate. So we saw voting and we also just consumption as well. We're seeing greater demand for green products and greater expectations on companies that produce these things to do more and to be better. And so both around carbon, but also now coming biodiversity and other things, social issues as well.
Looking to the next 5 to 10 years, what do you see our society really needing to adapt to?
Well, I think we've just touched on probably one of the biggest ones, which is climate. So climate change, we know it's coming. We know it's going to lead to more extreme weather events. It already has, already is. It's going to lead to rising sea levels. It's going to lead to disproportionate effects on those that are in lower socioeconomic brackets. We know that's going to happen. And so for me, they're things that we need to anticipate and adapt to now. From a behavioural scientist's perspective, what does that mean? Well, it means you've got to clean your gutters. If you live in a bushfire prone area or build in places where there isn't flood risk or less flood risk. But also in terms of mitigation, people need to move over to the use of green energy, green appliances, etc. So that's probably a big one. But of course, there are lots of other big changes. And if you look at the CSIRO Global Megatrends Report, we're going to see more and more AI and use of AI. It's likely to be there. Digitization. So there's a real move for governments in particular and even companies to get most of the work done online versus via a person. All sorts of health challenges, of course, as we have an aging population, particularly here in Australia. How do we deal with that? And certainly there's a bit of an erosion of trust in government. So most of this will come to us, not internally driven. But if we can get ahead of the game, then I think it'd be much less painful, much better if we can mitigate climate and anticipate adaptations now rather than waiting till bushfire comes or a flood comes or extreme heat.
Yeah, being on the back foot, hey? Yeah. What are some of the classic pitfalls that people can make in regards to trying to change others' behaviours?
Great question, Susie, and one that we grapple with a lot and one we try and teach for a number of the education courses we deliver. If I was to name one, and I think there's one really big one, it's the assumption of knowing what works. I think we see that all the time. I remember sitting in a room once where a $10 million campaign was designed because someone thought it was a good idea. A colleague of mine in the UK, Susan Mickey, talks about the Islagiat principle, which is essentially it seemed like a good idea at the time. And we see these cases of we think something works and they don't. And probably one of the well-cited cases is the Scared Straight program in the US, which is about trying to get delinquent kids back on track by making them spend time with criminals, essentially, to realise what life in jail and what a criminal life looks like. And the evidence synthesis of that really shows conclusively it doesn't work. In fact, it increases the chance that a delinquent youth will do the wrong thing, yet there's still over 20 states in the US that have a Scared Straight program, despite the overwhelming evidence. And it's based really on the idea of kids should suffer or be exposed to that and that's going to work, but actually it doesn't. And so that's kind of the category, but there are some sort of subcategories within that kind of I know what works part. And the first one I think is a really common one is that people feel like information will change behavior. Like they just need to know this stuff. Like, do you know if you buy that dishwasher, it's going to lead to this emissions that are worse than this dishwasher, it's going to lead to less emissions. And if we tell them that, that'll lead to better decision making. Or if you build that type of house that faces that direction or doesn't have that insulation or does whatever, then that will lead. But people might factor that in, but they'll have a whole bunch of other reasons why they want to do something. So information can be helpful, but it's often ineffective. And we see that often, and particularly when people are in habits mode, they're just not interested in your information because habits are serving them well. They're often described as having tunnel vision. When you're in a habitual mode, you're not really interested in anything outside the tunnel. So information or new information, unless it's really radical, like we'll give you $1 million to change your behavior, then yeah, sure. But if it's just sort of another reason why you might want to change your behavior, then people will tend to ignore it. So that's the first one. The second one is around norms. So we often see people using, we call them descriptive norms in psychology, which basically it's our assessment of what most people are doing. It describes the situation of how most people are behaving. And people use negative descriptive norms all the time in their persuasive arguments to say, did you know that X 100,000 tons of carbon were emitted that was unnecessary? Or do you know that X number of people die at the hands of a current or former intimate partner? And that kind of message is really trying to emphasize the size of a problem. But what we know is that emphasizing the size of a problem really means that we gravitate, it increases the likelihood people will follow suit because we tend to follow what most people do or our perception of what's normal. If you think about caveman selves, if a bunch of people are running, chances are you run with them too, right?
Yeah.
Or our modern caveman selves, if lots of people are watching something on Netflix and it's popular, we're more likely to follow suit too. So we follow norms and that's innate in us. So emphasizing that lots of people are doing the wrong thing or a bad thing, like the obesity epidemic or the ICE epidemic or these sorts of things, actually increases the chances that we'll follow suit.
Well, fascinating stuff. So how do we change behavior?
So what we would argue is equivalence but positive, right? So if we're talking about electric vehicles, so 5 or 10 years ago, there were very few. And if you were to say more people should buy electric vehicles, only 1% of people have considered it and only 0.5% have even bought one. That's a negative, right? I don't know what 1% of Australia's population is, but it's 200,000 or something, right?
Yeah.
200,000 people or 20,000, whatever the number is, have bought an electric vehicle. Wow, get on the bandwagon. That's a better message than the one that sort of emphasizes that most people aren't doing the thing you want to say most people are. So that's one antidote. The other kind of way that we suggest you can work with that is to use numbers. So you can say in 2015, Australia sold 5,000 EVs. In 2016, we sold 10. In 2017, we sold 20. In 2018, we sold 40. The number's just going up and up and up. And then people like to join bandwagons and get on board when something seems to be heading in that direction. So those sorts of messages can be antidotes to, I guess, negative descriptive norms. So that's what we'd encourage. Sometimes we get a bit of flack around that because there are lots of people that are passionate about issues and like to raise them and argue that they get the attention of politicians and other decision makers because of that. And I have a lot of empathy for that. But I do think once you get it on the public agenda, I think you need to shift and change that to more positive norm messages. The other one I didn't talk about is incentives, right? So that's another classic. We often say, oh, we just need incentives. And I've been that both financially, but also in terms of punishments, et cetera. And there are some great examples of incentives that have failed. So, you know, there's a classic one where Uri Nisi, who's a researcher, a behavioral economist, sort of talked about picking his kids up from childcare after school and was running late and driving like crazy to get there, even though there was no punishment associated with getting there.
Except for,
he was getting there. He was just going to be late, right?
Yeah.
And so the childcare centre got a bit annoyed with that and introduced a fine. And what they found was that the late pickups doubled as a result of introducing a fine. And the hypothesis really is that because you put a monetary price on being late, the social contract was kind of broken. Like, you're looking after my kids, I need to get there on time to make sure that I honour my side of the deal. It's sort of a personal thing. And then you've made it financial. And pretty honest, the fine was pretty small. So then people said, oh, well, I'll just pay that money and then I don't have any guilt. And they basically, the term they use is that crowded out the good reasons for doing it with financial reasons. Incentives can work, of course. So we have seen them work and work well, but we can see them backfire as well. So you just need to be a bit cautious with these.
Yeah, it sounds like it's kind of really moved from relationship to transactional in that moment.
Exactly. And that's the term crowding out. So if you pay someone for doing something they would otherwise do for free, then that's when you're sort of crowding them out with financial reasons when they had other reasons that they might have done it anyways.
What is the cutting edge research regarding human behaviour during change?
Well, I guess behaviour is change, right? So what our unit does is we often come in to try and change behaviour. So we are trying to get change where there isn't change. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard, right? Particularly when you're dealing with habits for the reasons we talked about before. People like habits, they're good for them, they give them mental space to do other things. And so they value them. And so trying to change them is difficult. One-off behaviors are much easier. So if you're just trying to get someone to tick box A instead of B, that's usually pretty easy. But when it's trying to change something that they do regularly, it's tricky. And I would argue that that is one area of research, is how do we break habits? How do habits form? And how long does it take to form a new habit? Is it different for different behaviors? They're all really interesting questions. There's only one study that's probably over 10 years old now that was looking at how long new habits take to form. And her research looked at a couple of behaviors. One was drinking a glass of water. One was doing push-ups and measured habituation around those two behaviors. The average was 66 days, but it varied between 18 for very fast adopters to, in fact, they had to extrapolate out because the experiment ended, but they would guess if the trajectory continued, it would be more like 254 days for the longer ones. So it really varies. And of course, the push-ups one took longer, right? But research is really missing. So we don't know, in order to reset a new habit and to form a habit so that it becomes automatic, which is the definition of a habit, we just don't know. Is it different for different people? Is it different for different behavior? It doesn't matter if you're replacing a behavior versus starting a new one. They're all tricky questions that we don't really know the answers to, and there's a lot of need for research.
So where do you start when you get a question like that from somebody, trying to understand that behaviour and trying to instigate change?
We've got a whole methodology which we articulate in our book, but we always start with what's existing evidence, of course. So we've got an evidence review group inside our team that really could try and focus on what do we know. And the two questions they're often asking is, what do we know about what drives this behaviour in this audience? And what works to change it? And their question. So we're trying to draw evidence from around the world, and we try and understand why people are doing the things they're doing. And interestingly, that to the previous question around what are some of the cutting areas of research, that's one of the really interesting things that we're curious about at the moment, which is why are people doing the things they do through a multi-level perspective? So obviously, if I was asked you, Susie, why do you do this podcast? You might give me some reasons, but there are broader societal reasons why you do it, and some things that you're probably not even conscious of, appetite for information more broadly, whatever. But these things that are happening at a broader scale, accessibility, digital goods, these sorts of things also driving the behavior or supporting it. And so that's a real cutting edge at the moment. I've got a doctoral student who's looking at repairing electrical items, particularly workhorse electrical items, so a kettle or a toaster or a microwave or a washing machine, things that you use regularly, right? And she's sort of saying, well, what is it that I can ask people why they do it or not, but actually there's a whole bunch of other factors that are much broader than that, including availability of spare parts, cost of spare parts, availability of services that can do it, and consumerism, the ease of purchase of some replacement, like I can just go buy a new kettle. Yes. So it's just trying to understand those multi-level drivers and how someone deciding whether they're going to recycle something or repair a broken electrical appliance will be influenced by all those things, and trying to unpack and understand those is a really interesting area of research, and one that we've got, in fact, a few PhDs really trying to investigate not only what those drivers are, but the methods of how you go about understanding and identifying what they might be.
Now, you're noticing over the passage of time that those variables are becoming more expansive?
Yes, from a behavioural science perspective, because I think, I mean, we're often just interested in what happens between the ears, right? So a lot of the behavioural scientists that are psychologists as a background are mostly interested in what happens between people's ears and whether that drives behavior. But from a behavioral scientist's perspective, yes, we are becoming fascinated more and more by these contextual factors, these other things that happen in society, you know, the growth of AI, digitization, desire for education, burgeoning middle class, etc. Like, we're interested more and more in how they're driving behavior. But I think they've always been there, right? Mm-hmm. It's just that we as behavioral scientists haven't really acknowledged them as much. Sociologists do, of course. Sure. So yeah. They often think about those, but they don't think necessarily so much about what goes in between the ears. So yeah. Those two disciplines probably need to come together a little bit more to help understand why people do the things they do.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. I'm going to move to a question now that we ask every one of our guests, and that is, what are you feeling uncertain about at the moment, and how are you best supporting yourself?
So I lead a research unit that has about 30-odd researchers who at any given time are working on 50 or 60 projects collectively. And the nature of the work we do is very applied. So we're not like what they call blue sky academics. We're not discovering things necessarily. We're usually taking those discoveries and applying them. And so our job is to try and work with partners to help solve a problem. The upshot of that means I'm aware of a lot of problems because I'm a director and I sort of oversee all that body of work, including the 600-odd projects that you mentioned at the start. I know a little about an awful lot. And that makes me worry about an awful lot, right? But it also gives me hope in some senses, because we also see some positive outcomes around some of these issues. But if I was to think about some that I'm particularly worried about, I'd say it's biodiversity loss. It's a really big one. Social inclusion, I think that's a significant problem, particularly with COVID. And inequality, in fact, is another one. Invariably, when change happens, it disproportionately affects those that are already disadvantaged. They almost always end up worse off, right? Mm-hmm. COVID's a classic example. Inequality, social inclusion, biodiversity loss, they're things that sort of concern me greatly. And at the broader scale, I guess the US election and the lunge to the right, we're seeing a little bit in some countries, New Zealand, the Netherlands, and just recently Austria have also gone that way as well. So all sort of leaning that way, which I think worries me a little bit, and particularly in the extremist views that can come with those. In terms of how do I unplug, I mean, I think once a year I always go away. Usually it's in January. In fact, it has been for the last 10 plus years. I go back to a nice spot in nature and really unplug and don't really think too much about work at all. That sort of recharges the batteries, if you like. I'd like to say I do that more often during the year, but honestly, I probably don't and probably should. But I really do look forward to that time of year, being able to not have to think or worry about some of these issues.
Mm-hmm. I can understand that. That's a lot of holding of a lot of issues, isn't it?
Yeah, our staff do that too. And the nice thing is we're always, because behaviour change and the way we work is always about trying to affect change, right? So we're always trying to help situations. And so we have wins in there too, right? So if we stop another species going extinct or help in that cause, or we get a few more people vaccinated or whatever that happens to be that's got a good social or environmental purpose, then that's invigorating. So that sort of recharges our batteries a little bit as we go along as well.
Yeah, fulfilling stuff, hey?
Making a difference. You know, I think that goes back to one of the first questions you asked me. Humans like cause and effect. We like to see if I do X, Y happens. That's in our nature. And I think that's true with researchers as much as anyone and me as well.
Australia is very lucky to have you, Professor Liam Smith. If you're inspired by a discussion with Liam, be sure to follow him on LinkedIn for more insights. For a deeper dive into behaviour change and sustainability, don't forget to check out his edited book, Inspiring Change, How to Influence Behaviour for a Better World. Liam, thanks so much for being here with us today on the Let's Check In podcast.
Thanks, Susie. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for checking in with me today. So you never miss an episode, hit follow or subscribe wherever you listen. If today's episode resonated, share it with someone who's navigating their own wobbly season. Find and follow us across Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and LinkedIn at Let's Check In Podcast. This podcast is not a licensed mental health service, and it is not a substitute for professional mental health advice. If something has come up for you in this episode, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14.